Good afternoon. My name is Yaniv Levy, and I'm from Ex Libris. I'm the product manager of Rosetta, which is the digital preservation system developed in conjunction with the National Library of New Zealand. I'm not used to talking with a mic, so please forgive me. So before, I decided not to talk about why digital preservation is important. I decided not to talk about the system into depth, about how we developed things, how does the system structured, etc. What I decided to talk about is I took five, what I describe as five challenges. If I'm talking too fast, just hint me. Five challenges that we have chosen, that we have encountered during the development of the system, and how did we solve those challenges in the system? What did we do in the system to address those, what I would perceive as preservation challenges when you build a preservation system? But before we start, I'll give a very short update where we are with the system. As Steve Knight from the National Library of New Zealand has mentioned, the system has gone live with version 1 in the National Library of New Zealand. We had a general release in 2009, beginning of 2009, and the system is a full-blown system from the ingest through the storing through the delivery of the information. Some of the work that was involved, we have invested a lot of work in developing this preservation system. These are some numbers. It was a lot of effort. It was almost 30 people in a length of 2 years, and we are continuing to develop the systems. The system, we have invested a lot in the specs. Also, based on a lot of information and a lot of work done by the National Library of New Zealand on defining the requirements, etc. I think the National Library of New Zealand will be more than happy to share those requirements. So, let's go into the challenges. And the first challenge I chose is, what is digital preservation? Steve mentioned that a little bit earlier, but how do we define digital preservation? Because when we started to build a system, we need to have a good definition of what is digital preservation. And they need it. Okay. Okay, here. Ah, yes, in my pocket. Thank you. Yeah, that would make sense. And it's calling now, so yeah. Okay. Sorry. So what is digital preservation? You know, I've collected a few images. I don't know if you identify them or not, but the earthquake, oh, lovely things that happened. The earthquake in San Francisco, the big fire of London, etc., Katrina, and just a flood. And the reason I choose these images is to emphasize that this is only part of digital preservation. Because many people, when they think about digital preservation, they say, we need good redundancy. We need good storage. But that is not sufficient. Because when we talk about digital preservation, there's a paradox. And this is quite old. This quote is quite old. It's from 2002. And it talks about the paradox of digital preservation. And I'll read it. Traditionally, preserving things means keeping them unchanged. However, our digital environment has fundamentally changed our concept of preservation requirements. If we hold on to digital information without modification, accessing the information will become increasingly difficult, if not impossible. And this is the paradox of talking about digital preservation, because when people think about preservation, at least people in library and archives, they think about these carefully temperatured rooms where nobody goes in, or, you know, it's a lock, nobody allows to touch the book, to turn the pages because it's dangerous. Everything has to change to stay unchanged. But when we talk about digital preservation, suddenly, if we keep things unchanged, all we have at the end of the day is zeros and ones, which might be nice, but will be meaningless. And this is the challenge of digital preservation. How do we, on the one hand, do passive preservation, keep the information the same, but on the other hand, ensure that what we have kept is also accessible over time. And Lynn Brintley, the director of the British Library, at the opening of iPress, mentioned that maybe we should change the name from digital preservation to access over time. Okay, I don't care how we call it. It doesn't matter if we call it digital. She claims digital preservation is confusing. I don't care if we call it digital preservation or access over time. But our main goal when doing digital preservation is ensuring that the information is accessible by end users or by users in general over time. I'll skip this one. And this is a quote and a definition of what is digital preservation by ALA, the American Library Association. I won't read it. I just want to emphasize two issues. The goal of digital preservation is the accurate rendering of authenticated content over time. And when we think about a digital preservation, what we need to think is how would it be possible for our grandchildren, our children of our grandchildren, to actually access the information. Because if you look back just 10 years ago or 20 years ago, the information that was created 20 years ago in WordPerfect, I don't know what systems that you use here in Slovakia, but are not accessible or have big problems to be accessed even today. And this is just a time span of 20 years. Okay. And I think this is my definition. Okay? When I have to define what are the three elements of digital preservation, this is my definition. And I think this explains some of the confusion around digital preservation. Because what we need is, if we talk about digital preservation, is three parts. First, we need to collect the information. We need to store it in a central place. Because, and this is a quote by Priscilla Kaplan, who's an expert from FCLA in North America about preservation. She says, if you don't own the content, how can you preserve it? So the first step is collecting and making sure you have it. This is very similar to what you would do at home. You would have a special drawer with all your important documents, a passport, your marriage certificate. Different people will define what's important differently, but we won't go into that. But that's the first level. The next step is what I call archiving. Ensuring that what I have in that drawer stays the same over time. So I might put a lock on the drawer. I might put it in a safe just to make sure that it's safe over time. And the third thing is preserving. And that's what's unique about digital preservation, is making sure that what we've put in that drawer can be renderable over time, can be readable over time. And I think, why is this the source of the confusion of what is digital preservation? Digital preservation is the combination of all three. Whether a system that does collecting, a system that does archiving, does it do digital preservation? Yes, but only part of the digital preservation. And these are the three things, in my view, you have to take into account when you talk about digital preservation. This was the first challenge. The second challenge, okay, the data model. We understood, how do we perceive the pieces of the system? What should the system should address? The next challenge is, how do we build a data model? And here are some of the goals of the data model that we had in mind. We wanted a data model that will fit long-term digital preservation. We wanted a data model to support a variety of material and fields. So something that will support libraries, archives, and museums. And we wanted it to be standard and open. We, in our view, the way we need, what we need to do in order to preserve things over time, we need to collect them, we need to standardize them. So, and store them as an archival information package. This is from the OAIS. store them in one standard way. So when you actually want to do preservation actions, you can do it because it's stored in a standard way. And the challenge here is, how do you store it in the standard way for different fields? So we chose to use Premise, which is preservation metadata. I don't know how many of you are familiar with Premise, wrapped in a METS file. We decided that we will use the Premise elements, but we will allow some extensibility, so using a standard on the one hand, but allow additional fields if needed, because what we see is that some institutions need different elements, and also support for some of the archival structures, because as Steve mentioned, I too see, as we move on, the concept of archives, especially when we talk about the numbers of digital objects, will seep into the digital preservation arena. We will not be able to describe everything. We will need to have some conceptual decisions similar to what they have done in archives for many years. So this is the conceptual module. If you want, we can discuss it later. I'll skip it for now. The third challenge. Droid, Jove, Pronom, and other open source. And I'll just mention what is each so you would be aware if you're not familiar. Droid is a tool to identify the format, but not just the extension. So not only it's a Word document, it's a Word 6 document, Word 7, same PDF 1.4, 1.5, etc. Jove is a tool to actually also identify the format, but also validate the format. So if it says it's a PDF 1.4, is it actually a valid PDF 1.4? Pronom is a registry of all the formats maintained by the UK Archives, and there are other open source tools that we're using. Why do we use all these tools? We want to do a process that is called characterization, which our feeling is that that's crucial when you talk about digital preservation. You need to know what you have, and you need to know that what you have is valid. In order to measure the risk of what you're storing, you need to know that what you're receiving is actually good. And for that, we are using these open source tools. But what we have encountered is that using these open source tools is not very simple. Because in many cases, and I will not refer to any one of those in specific, but in many cases, there are overlapping functionality between the two. In many cases, these tools have problems in them. They don't work as expected. They're not scalable enough to perform 1 million checks in 1 week. It takes 18 seconds to check a file. There's no UI. You have to use it. You have to combine the results. You have to mix and merge between the results. So how do you actually deal with that? Of course, my wish is that, of course, these open source tools would be perfect tools and everything would work. But we have to work with what we have. Okay, so I pledge the community to improve these tools, etc., and we're doing that process in parallel. But what we have built in the system, and that's why it was a challenge using these tools. Furthermore, when we had a problem, there was no one to actually address it. So what we tried to do is to build a framework within the system, a framework that allows you to actually deal with the problems alerted by the system. So we have a role of a technical analyst that deals with the problems. We have a whole rule-based decision-making. I'll give you one example of what is the difference between saying you're using Droid and actually using Droid. We found out that when you use Droid, this tool to identify the formats, something like 50 to 60% fail Droid. It's good if you have 10 files. then you can deal with 60% failure. Dealing with six files is not very difficult. But when you have 1 million, 2 million, 3 million objects dealing with 600,000, a million, etc., that's not reasonable. So the question is, how do you automate the process in order to make it better? So we had developed a whole rule mechanism to determine what, in each case, how to choose the right format. So if it comes from this producer in this workflow, choose this, and these are the outputs of Droid, choose this format. Again, we put a lot of effort into automating the process. Again, scalable. So if it takes 14 seconds to do something, we have to parallelize it to make it work on many computers. And if we talk about pronom as a format registry does not include all the formats. So we had to develop a local format library to complete the format registry by pronom. Okay, so I'll do this very quickly. This is some screenshots of the system. This is the technical analyst workbench where he can deal with problems. You can see the different tools that we are using, virus, fixity, format validation, etc. This shows you the exceptions. Here is the specific exception. I'll skip that quickly. And here, for example, is a set of rules for automatically decision-making of what is the format. And this is a configurable per policy of institution. So this is how we dealt with the challenge of using open source tools, using characterization tools, which work, but not 100%. There's still more room for improvement, but we tried to do the maximum with what we have. The other thing, the other challenge is, how do you make a system that works with the library existing infrastructure? You don't want to create yet another silo in the library. You want to create something that can work in the environment of the library. And I'll give you one example, and that's the metadata editing, the descriptive metadata editing. You don't want to create yet another descriptive management tool. You want to use existing tools that librarians and archivists are used to using along their current existing processes to create descriptive metadata. And this was the challenge. How do we actually don't try to invent, and sometimes it's easier to invent because we think we know better, invent everything in the system. How do we integrate with external systems? So what we have built is we tried to build a very open system. And I didn't go through the architecture, but we have different modules. You can see down here the deposit, the working area, operational, permanent, the different areas of the system. And what we have built is a set of APIs, SDKs, to actually integrate with the system. And Steve has mentioned they have built Indigo. They also built an integration with a web archiving tool called the WCT. So that tool automatically harvests the web and then pushes it into Rosetta automatically. Again, the goal is to automate these processes. The same goes with descriptive information. The descriptive continues to be, in their case, Voyager or Tapui, which is their archival information system, and the system knows how to automatically integrate and take the information from those systems, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, I'm fine. This is the last challenge. One of the most common question when I talk about preservation is, and this goes back to the guy from Oxford who talked earlier. How do we ensure that the preservation system itself is not a bottleneck? Okay, the question that is commonly asked is, how do we preserve the preservation system? Okay, we're talking about 100 years, we're talking about 200 years, probably in 100 years, as much as I hope, Exlibris will probably either will be a huge company, etc., as I hope, but might not be here around. Okay, so how do we address that issue? I didn't go into the architecture, but what I want to focus on is on what is what we call the permanent repository. How do we view the permanent repository? And many of the ideas that were mentioned by Oxford earlier are represented in the permanent repository. The idea of the permanent repository is that everything that we considered preservation worthy, and that's mainly the content and the metadata and the technical metadata, the descriptive metadata, is stored on disk. Why on disk? As disk is proven technology. You can reconstruct everything from the disk. You can reconstruct everything into, we use Oracle, but in the future, you can use a different system, a different database. The way we store the information is open. We base it on standards. As I mentioned, it's premise wrapped with METS. And the idea is, yes, we provide what we call an operational repository that allows searching, allows creating sets, allows doing preservation actions on the data, allows risk grading on the data. But in the future, if Oracle goes away, if Exlibris goes away, if Rosetta goes away, you can take that data and actually load it into a new system. I didn't go through these five challenges are just example of challenges that we have encountered when we developed the digital preservation. There are many more challenges, and these are just example. How do you deal with scalability? You know, the numbers that were mentioned, authenticity, fixity, security, etc., and many other challenges. In half an hour, that's not a lot of time, but it's very, very interesting. And I think that developing a preservation system is also very interesting because it's a new field. There's no best practices out there that you can actually say, oh, this is what I need to do. This goes back to my first challenge. What is a preservation system? And you really feel that you're building a new road in a way. So thank you. And I just want to end with the Rosetta Stone and maybe give you a little bit of insight. Why did we choose the name Rosetta? Because I think it's a good example of preservation. You know, when we chose the Rosetta Stone, people came to me and said, why for, you know, this is a system of the future. Why do we choose something which is 2,200 years old? And I think that Rosetta Stone, I'll explain what is the Rosetta Stone for those who are not familiar. I hope that everyone is, but just in case. The Rosetta Stone is a stone written in three languages. One of them is the hieroglyphs in Egypt. It was found in Egypt about 200 years ago. And using that stone, they were able to read the hieroglyphs. Champollion, a soldier in the Napoleon army, was able to decrypt the hieroglyphs. And the reason why this Rosetta Stone is a good representation of digital preservation, as much as it might sound absurd, is the fact that it represents both active preservation and passive preservation. Passive preservation, because if we will be able to maintain the information that we actually collect for 2,200 years, I think we've done a good job. Okay? I think that, and that's what we should thrive for. Whether we be successful, you know, we can be judged only 2,200 years ago from now. But that's what we have to think about. But the other side of things, this is not only passive preservation, but the fact that they have used the three languages enabled someone coming almost 1,000, 1,500 years later to actually understand what's written. Okay? So in a way, this is exactly the active preservation. Because if we had, let's take Mayan language from South America. We have all kinds of idioms, but we cannot, like pictures, but we don't understand what they say. They're meaningless for us. But the fact that this guy, I don't know, 2,200 years ago, chosen to write it in three languages actually enabled people 2,200 years later to actually read the information and understand it. So I think it's a good example of both active preservation and passive preservation. And that's it. Thank you very much.